For the week of October 30th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 342, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York City, perched on the edge of a bed near City Hall, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you perched on the edge of a bed? First of all, why are you near City Hall, but why are you on a bed?
Well, I'm staying with a friend downtown, and I was upstairs, but the Wi-Fi wasn't working up there, so I went back down to my room when the Wi-Fi is working good, but the sun is too bright on the windowsill, so I couldn't put the computer there. So to avoid the sun and get the good Wi-Fi, I am perched on the edge of a bed downtown near City Hall.
Okay, I actually thought that had something to do with, like, a news story or some, you know, something you were covering, but no, it's your actual physical location.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, so now we have updated all of our listeners onto maybe one of the most important...
Where do you sit when you are doing the show?
In the studio.
Yes, and where's the studio?
Okay, granted, it is in my home, but seriously, it's a little studio that I've set up.
Is that what you call it, or is it your man cave, or is it an actual just a studio?
It's just a studio.
Oh, well done.
You know, that's how important I think this show is. I've built an entire studio just for Showbiz Sandbox.
Does your wife refer to it as your hobby room?
No comment.
Well, if she listens to this week's show, what will she hear about?
On this week's show, we're going to focus again on China. Hollywood has been talking up China's explosive box office growth for years, and now that this growth is slowing down, Hollywood is, well, justifiably worried and concerned. We'll be joined by LA Times reporter Ryan Fonder to talk about what's happening in China's cinemas, why, and what it means for the major studios. Fonder will also give us the lowdown on how some studios, specifically Lionsgate, are turning to YouTube stars for what they hope will be their next big hit. During our book filter segment, Michael will get all William Shawn on us and explain why a collection of doodles from The New Yorker is the best book of the week. I call it a comic book. He calls it a book. I don't get it. On Inside Baseball, we'll cover the latest in that potential merger between AT&T and Time Warner. You might recall we talked about it last week. We're going to talk about the merger again, including their new argument for why it would be a plus for consumers. Their answer, get this, targeted ads.
Yay!
Oh, goody. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, which explains why the number one movie of the week hasn't opened up yet here in North America. It's Doctor Strange, the Benedict Cumberbatch launch of a new Marvel franchise. $86 million over the weekend. It opened in 33 territories, and it's getting quite good reviews. I think one of the trades said it was the best Marvel movie since Spider-Man 2, which means they say it's better than all of the ones we've seen since then, like Iron Man and Avengers and all those movies. So that's a pretty strong recommendation, and we'll have to see how it ends up here in North America, but I'm actually excited to see it.
You know, I would ordinarily say, who's Doctor Strange? I've never even heard of this guy, but then I guess the same could have been said about Iron Man.
And Ant-Man and many others.
Exactly. And of course, I'm joking. I know who Doctor Strange is, but I guess I'm looking at it and going, you made a whole movie about that guy?
I guess I'm not joking. I never read the comic book. It didn't run very long.
No, so I didn't read it, but I know, I certainly know the character.
Barely, only because they're making a movie out of it. That's all the only reason I know about it. But I do know it's opened up on a lot of screens, including a couple hundred IMAX screens. And next week, when it opens up even wider, including North America, it will be on 1,000 IMAX screens worldwide. It's the biggest IMAX spread in history, I believe.
That's pretty remarkable when you think about it, especially when you think about the fact that an IMAX screen, usually there's like some clearance. In other words, you can't put an IMAX screen across the street from an IMAX screen. They're usually, 20-mile radius.
That's with the IMAX branding, that has fallen.
Yes, I would think that certainly for the traditional IMAX, yes. I don't know about the smaller IMAX screens.
Well, that's what we're talking about, obviously.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's IMAX branded screens. I took that as implied. But that's a very, very broad release for IMAX, and they get to charge more money. So we'll have to see how that helps the bottom line. And number two is a movie that could use help on the bottom line. It's Inferno, the latest Ron Howard, Tom Hanks movie based on novels by Dan Brown. This one opened pretty poorly in North America. It made $44 million worldwide over the weekend. It got beat out in the number one slot in the U.S. At worldwide, though, it's at $150 million. So it'll probably be okay when all is said and done, but I doubt they'll be rushing to adapt The Lost Symbol, which is the next and perhaps last Dan Brown adventure.
You know, I loved Guy Lodge's headline or subheadline for his review of this movie. He said that it, you know, Inferno is a cinematic, a reliable or faithful cinematic representation of the Dan Brown book, which is to say it's pretty, and I can't say, you know, it's pretty crappy.
Where was that headline?
I can't remember whether it was The Guardian or Variety. You know, Guy Lodge writes for so many different outlets. He's a great journalist and critic. And I don't know which outlet it was. I saw it on Twitter.
Well, in the old days, I would say, oh, you know, the headline probably wasn't written by him, so I don't know if I should credit him. But these days, frankly, the journalists have to get the photos, they have to write the headlines, do the layout, so perhaps he did write it. Who knows?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
At number three around the world is the animated film Trolls, which has a hit single. We'll have to see if it's going to be a hit movie. It made $30 million over the weekend. It's at $61 million worldwide. At number four is the Tom Cruise film Jack Reacher, Never Go Back. $21 million over the weekend and just under $100 million worldwide. And number five is the movie that beat out Inferno in North America. It was a big upset this weekend. Tyler Perry's Boo! A Madea Halloween grossed $16 million, had a good hold because it opened the weekend before Halloween, and now it is Halloween weekend, and it did quite well. It's made $52 million so far for a movie that cost $20 million to make. They're going to be just fine. Now the question is, why? Obviously, they're not going to open it up overseas because it's Halloween themed, right?
Yeah, and I don't necessarily know how the Madea films play overseas.
Well, Madea, and they have not, I looked it up, they have not been opening it up in the rest of the world at all, which I think is a big mistake, and it's money left on the table, so they haven't built up that franchise. And in this case, of course, since it's themed to a particular holiday, they're clearly not going to start with this one. And number six is The Accountant, the Ben Affleck potential franchise, $16 million over the weekend, $82 million worldwide. And number seven is a horror film, which will surely drop off pretty hard after Halloween. It's Ouija, Origin of Evil, $15 million over the weekend, $45 million worldwide. And number eight is a movie we'll talk about a little bit more down once we're done with the box office. It's a Bollywood film called This Heart is Complicated, or Idil Hai Mushkil. It's written and directed by Karan Johar. It grossed $12 million over the weekend. And in a great success story, it's number 10 movie in North America. It opened on 300 screens and made like 2.2 million or something like that in the U.S. So it broke into the top 10. So that's really a new trend that we're seeing, and it's kind of exciting.
Well, yeah, $2.1 million. And I've always said, gee, I think that there's a market here. You know, they've been cycling these prints through the U.S. And so they've never actually been able to do it all in one weekend. It's been, you know, one weekend in Portland, another weekend in Seattle, and then a weekend in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And so by the time it was done, maybe it had made, you know, $3 million. Although I don't necessarily know that that's even true. Now they can do it all at once when the film opens in India.
Because it's digital?
Because it's digital, yes.
Well, I think it's also more that you're seeing them carried in multiplexes. It's just not in the Bollywood circuit. You know, there are cinemas in certain neighborhoods in major cities devoted to Bollywood films and Japanese and Korean. And in this case, you're seeing them on multiplexes downtown. I see them in Birmingham, Alabama at the local multiplex. Every weekend, there is a Bollywood movie there. So I think it's also a question of that. It's both easier because you've got digital prints. It's not as cheap as it could be, right? But it is technically easy to do, and more multiplexes are showing them.
Correct.
And number nine is the Tim Burton film Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, $11 million over the weekend. Perhaps it got a boost from Halloween, I don't know, but $250 million worldwide. So it has a little ways to go before we can call it a success. And number 10 is The Girl on the Train, $11 million over the weekend, $115 million worldwide. At number 11 is a Chinese comedy called Mr. Donkey. It's about a local village that uses money that they're supposed to use for a teacher, and they use it to buy a donkey that helps bring them water. Obviously, they desperately needed it. But then the charity comes a-calling to see how everything is going, so they have to convince some guy to pretend to be Mr. Donkey, their new teacher. Ha ha ha. Hilarity ensues, I guess. But it made $8 million over the weekend. It's got $9 million total, so I guess it opened on a Wednesday or a Thursday. Jumping down the list, one movie of note is that number 17 is Death Note. Light Up the New World. It's a Japanese thriller based on the manga Death Note, and it's the latest in a franchise that's been pretty profitable. It made $4.4 million over the weekend, but get this, we've had Two movies were released in 2006. Then there was a spinoff released in 2008. Then just this September, we had a TV miniseries that filled in the gap from 2006 to today. And now we have this new movie following up the storyline. So that's one, two, three, four films and a TV miniseries all spun off from a manga. I'm not familiar with this franchise, but it's certainly making money in Japan. So I wanted to go back to circle back to the movie This Heart is Complicated, because there's a political controversy surrounding the movie. It opened in the U.S. on 300 screens. It did quite well. But back in India, there were calls from what I'll call at this stage a fringe nationalist party to say they should not show this movie in theaters because it features Pakistani actors. There was a terrorist attack in September. By some accounts, it was the worst in 20 years. And people in India were saying we should not have any films with Pakistani actors ever again. There was a group of theater owners that joined this boycott. They're called I don't have their name, but they seem to represent theater owners who have single screen cinemas. So you're talking about cinemas in small towns and villages, not the large multiplexes. And so this group said, yes, we won't show this movie or movies with Pakistani actors, but they don't represent the big multiplexes, which is where this sort of large budget type of movie is going to play. So it seemed to be a boycott without a purpose. The director came out and said, hey, look, I made this movie before the terrorist attack. I promise not to use Pakistani actors in the future. So, you know, give this movie a break, which then got its own blowback from other people who said, why are you caving into this nationalist sentiment? So it's a very ugly situation. But the movie did open. It did do well. And you can see all the complications in Bollywood. There's a movement, at least from some on the fringe, to say don't ever use Pakistani actors. I don't know what they think about cinematographers or script writers or directors, but they don't want to see Pakistani actors on screen, I guess, ever again, frankly. It wasn't just about this movie. It was about movies in general. So you can see how this is it's a romantic drama. It has nothing to do with politics, and yet it got caught up in the sort of nationalist fervor. It did not affect the release of the movie, but it is something to pay attention to down the road.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, India, and I'm only speaking cinematically here. I can't really speak, as far as
culturally
yeah. or... Well, even culturally, I know that there's different languages spoken, different dialects in different parts of the country. But cinematically, the territories are quite, quite different.
Well, yeah. In fact, this was the theater owners of single screen cinemas, which are the smaller houses, mom and pop cinemas. They said they would not show this movie in four specific territories. So it wasn't a countrywide ban, which I didn't quite follow. But as you say, perhaps it has to do with the different cultures and traditions. Though if you think it's unacceptable to show a movie here, I don't know why you think it would be acceptable to show it there. Either it's bad to show movies with Pakistani actors or it's good. But yeah, those sort of cross-cultural things are definitely flaring up. It's a big, diverse country, as is China. And India has its own huge industry, but it has never crossed as much over into the rest of the world. But we're seeing that happen a little bit more, and we're obviously also seeing that happen in China, aren't we?
Yes, we are. In fact, Michael, we're going to be joined by Ryan Fonder, a staff writer with the Los Angeles Times, to talk about a couple of stories that he wrote. But first, as you were mentioning China, why don't we cover China? Of course, we've talked about this, it seems like, endlessly, that China effectively is taking over the world, at least when it comes to theatrical box office. When China's box office surpasses North America as the number one box office in the world is anyone's guess, although everybody likes to seem to want to guess, and it seems to be around 2017, 2018 is the best guess that everybody has. But now, it seems this year, box office there has declined about 10%. Here to tell us why, or at least maybe why, is Ryan Fonder with the Los Angeles Times. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, Ryan, I wanted to start off by asking what it's like to cover China, because obviously in the last few years, we're talking a lot more about China companies buying American companies, the Chinese box office, Chinese films traveling the world. You share your story, this particular story, with a byline with, a stringer in Beijing named Yanan Wang. I assume he or she speaks Mandarin or Cantonese, and I assume you don't.
That's right. You got it. I am, stuck in LA, and, it is definitely interesting trying to cover the China business from a desk in downtown Los Angeles. But, those are the constraints at the moment.
Yeah, just the time frame alone is a challenge. But I also wondered over the last few years, if you found more people in Chinese companies that speak English or speak English better, or do they expect you to learn more Cantonese, or what's going on? What's the sort of mindset?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people, including professors and business people that I talk to over there, are pretty much fluent in English. I mean, it's a very, very minor hurdle, the language difference, really. I mean, the point of having the stringer of Yun Wang do her work so well in China, in Beijing specifically, was to get some actually on the ground reporting there and get people to actually, tell us from the theaters what they thought about the movie business and what they thought about, box office and the movies that they were seeing and the slowdown and everything.
Yes. In fact, when I reached out to see whether you might be available to join us today, I thought, well, wait a second. In the article, he's talking about, they're talking about actually being at the theater. Ryan might be in China, in fact.
Not this time, but hopefully someday. That'd be nice.
Is there something about the business culture or something in the Chinese film industry that you've learned that is new or different from North America, or their attitudes slightly different?
Well, I mean, the stereotype, I guess, is that Chinese business people do business very differently from the way we do. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was sort of questionable, like, whether any of these deals were actually ever going to happen. There was always a big press conference and a splashy press release, and the thinking in the back of your mind was, okay, is this real? Is this real money? How is this money even going to come out of China? But now it seems like it's more real, at least from the deal side. Like, these deals and acquisitions are actually happening.
But really, it seems to me that most of these deals revolve around one company in China. And I know I'm kind of, being hyperbolic in a way. It does seem like Wanda is doing most of these deals.
Yeah, Wanda is definitely the 800-pound gorilla in this business in China. And you saw that, a couple of weeks ago when the chairman of Dolly and Wanda Group came out to LACMA in Los Angeles to give a big press conference to a bunch of Hollywood executives and Chinese film executives, basically touting their new 408-acre movie park that includes a giant studio production facility. And he's here basically trying to get to Hollywood studios and producers to produce at that facility with a pretty mighty incentive, I might add, pretty robust rebate of about 40% on production.
Should we be calling Wanda the 800-pound panda, perhaps?
There you go. I like that. That's a lot of bamboo.
Yeah. So we talked about that story last week, and this week we're looking at the box office, which has been growing by leaps and bounds. In 2014 to 15, it grew by like 40%. This year, it looks like the growth is going to be more like 12%, which is not as much, obviously, as 40%. But so the growth is continuing. It's just slowing down. It looks like in 2016, the box office in China will be about $7.5 billion, which is natural since they have three times as many people as North America. You would expect someday soon they will surpass us. They are building a lot of screens, but the box office growth is slowing a bit. And the question is why? And you have a lot of reasons in your story. The first one that's mentioned is a poor film lineup. And I'm wondering if that is referring to Chinese films or overseas films, basically Hollywood, or whether it's a combination of the both.
Well, I mean, we've been complaining in the U.S. about crummy movies for years, so that's really nothing new. I mean, the fact is that China keeps building screens at this breathtaking clip. And, a year ago, there were some analysts saying that the box office there would eclipse the U.S. By, at the end of this year or by early next year, which in retrospect looks a little bit looks a little bit optimistic. So, yeah, I mean, the the Chinese have been trying to improve their film quality, and that's part of the purpose of doing all these deals with U.S. companies, is to learn how to make better movies. But it does appear that Chinese audiences are, you know, just like us. They're tired of throwing good money after bad films.
Although, actually, you kind of end your piece with Ms. Wang saying that, there was, you were quoting a moviegoer who said, I really like the superhero movies. I thought, oh, trust us, you don't want just superhero movies because you'll be going even less.
Right. I mean, superhero movies haven't really, you know, fallen off a cliff here. So, you know, I'd expect them to keep working around the world for a while. They're kind of like the new Westerns in a way. I mean, they're just kind of...
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a genre that's, going. You know, you can think it'll fade out, but it's going to last for quite a while. Another reason
exactly.
that you give needs a little explained for North American audiences, and it's the lack of discounts from online ticket sellers. Because in China, there's this tradition that these online ticket sellers trying to gain market share have been selling tickets at a discount. Say it should be $10, they would sell it to you online for $6 just so they could get your information and your credit card and make you be a loyal customer. So people got used to these really heavily discounted tickets. And now that those companies are sort of mature and the market share is stabilizing, they're not giving the big discounts anymore. So suddenly those tickets cost more to the consumer down at the end of the line, right?
Right. I mean, can't you imagine if your consumer in LA used to paying, you know, $10-$11 for a ticket and suddenly it shoots up to $20-$22 a ticket? I mean, I'd stay home. That'd be a tough sell, even if the movies were really good.
Yeah, I mean, actually, when I was at the Lake Geneva Convention, which is an industry trade show in Wisconsin this past September, one of the subjects I was on a panel for was the Chinese film market. And they, one of the subjects that came up were these discounted tickets and how the tickets were being sold. And they're all pretty much being sold mobile. 80% of tickets in China are sold through a mobile device, through WeChat. There's the Alibaba Picture
Group. Alibaba.
Yeah. There's WePow.
Right.
And so they were kind of, they would go in and purchase all of the tickets for a specific screening or a specific showing at a theater. And then the exhibitor, the movie theater owner, didn't care whether anybody showed up for the most part because all the tickets were sold. And then it was up to those mobile apps to go out and sell those tickets. To do so, they would sell them at a discounted rate. And I wondered at the time, publicly on this panel, whether the Chinese box office was artificially inflated, possibly subsidized by these companies. And it looks like maybe that might be part of the case.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell how much of it is, you know, a decline from a real box office total, you know, a year ago, or a decline from a fake box office total a year ago. Because you had even had instances of movie ticket inflation. Where companies were actually using fraudulent means to say that a movie was doing better in China than it actually was. And the Chinese government, you know, to their credit, has actually cracked down on this practice. So that, coupled with the disappearing of the discounts, I think, is putting a big roadblock
in China. What was the benefit of that, of saying, hey, a movie X or a movie Y is doing better than it actually is? Most of those, from my understanding, were, well, this Chinese movie is doing better than Iron Man 9 or whatever, you know, Hollywood import was. Is that the case?
I think that's it. I think it's the perception issue. I think it's the PR piece of it too. You know, the most recent example was the box office returns for Ip Man 3, which is a sequel to a Kung Fu movie. That was produced in China and starred Mike Tyson in one of the roles, I might add, conversely.
I hear he's a wonderful actor.
Wonderful performance. And so that was the subject of one of these investigations, one of these crackdowns by Chinese regulators, who noticed that these were that they were using possibly fraudulent means to inflate the grosses.
So the fact is that we may be getting a more accurate picture of the Chinese box office rather than seeing an actual slowdown in the growth. We're just seeing a better picture of where it actually is at today. Another factor that you mentioned is a lot of theaters are being built. New screens are being built outside the major urban centers. You had, of course, the big multiplexes going up in Shanghai and Beijing and these major cities, Guangzhou. Now we're seeing movie theater screens being built in suburban areas, in slightly more rural areas. And in those places, just like in America, you're going to have lower ticket prices and you're going to have people with less disposable income. So the new theaters that are being built in places where you're not going to get the same level of attendance or the same ticket price.
Right. And I think there was an assumption that, you know, if you just kept building, you know, people would come. And, you know, I think we're starting to see the signs that, you know, that may not necessarily be the case. It may not necessarily be a sure thing that you're going to see these, you know, giant leaps in box office attendance just because you're building more theaters and more people have access to more movies.
Well, and you kind of mentioned earlier that, you know, specifically with the 40% rebate and this big movie studio in Qingdao, that effectively they're inviting Hollywood over so that they can learn, and they being the distributors there, can learn how to make movies and then go do it themselves. But that's kind of been a long-running fear about working in China and dealing with Chinese companies, is that effectively they will copy whatever you're doing and do it cheaper and faster.
Right, exactly.
Has that been discussed at all in your conversations with executives? Do you hear that fear?
No, I mean, people aren't really expressing those kinds of worries to me, in Hollywood. I mean, it's kind of, you can just see that, you know, they're so far behind in terms of, you know, what the storytelling, and they sort of, you know, executives from there sort of admit that the movie product just isn't that good. I mean, you do hear people worrying about the, you know, out and out piracy of movies in China. That's still a thing. That's still a concern of, you know, the MPAA and, you know, other advocates. But, you know, I don't think it doesn't seem like there's really concern that they're going to, you know, overtake Hollywood's production capacities anytime soon.
Yeah, I always feel like that concern is overblown, because I think Hollywood benefits when there are good movies coming from France and Germany and Spain. You get talented filmmakers, they come over and they make Hollywood blockbusters, or they just make movies that bring business to, you know, theater goers in America. And I think the same will be true for China and Hong Kong. We've already seen a lot of crossover, but the better movies they make, well, now you've got another great movie that can make big business worldwide. It's good for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want to have more, you know, Ang Lees in the business, and who wouldn't want to have more movies that were like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon that came sort of out of nowhere from the East and did huge business worldwide? I mean, that's kind of hard to argue that that would be a bad thing.
I do think, though, that Hollywood may be concerned because they said, oh, here's this new cash cow, and now it's slowing down. It's not as robust and as quickly as they hoped for. But isn't this really an opportunity? Because one of the things that may be holding back the Chinese box office is the fact that there's this tension between two groups. You've got the people making movies who want to keep Hollywood films out to a certain degree, and that's why there's a limit on the number of Hollywood movies. And then you've got the people who own the theater chains who say, hey, we want in as many Hollywood movies as possible. So with the box office slowing down, isn't it possible that could create a crack in the wall and allow more big Hollywood movies to come year round because they just need movies to show in their theaters?
Right. Actually, that's a great point. And actually, that is already happening. You're starting to see less restrictions on what kinds of movies are coming into China from Hollywood. I mean, just last weekend, we saw the Jack Reacher sequel from Paramount get a debut in China. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine that, you know, a couple of years ago, that's the kind of movie that would have gotten a big release there, because it certainly didn't do huge business stateside. Look at this weekend, we have a movie from Sony called Inferno, which is like the third in the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code series. You know, it's kind of hard to imagine that would have gotten a big release in China a couple of years ago due to the quota. And here it is. It's in China making $13 million in U.S. dollars, which is okay, not huge. But, you know, it is starting to see like a little bit of a lower bar Hollywood getting into China.
Well, as anybody who knows me and who listens to this show regularly can attest, I have said, look, if any country built that many screens that quickly and they kept building that many screens, they're going to need one thing. If you're building a lot of stores, you're going to need a lot of product to put on those shelves. And so you can't keep restricting product flow, whether it's from Hollywood or anywhere in the world. You're going to need a lot of product. So you're going to need to either make it yourself or bring it in from somewhere else. And so I guess we're reaching the point where it's the bring it in from somewhere else part.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Yeah.
And that brings us to another story that you wrote, which is about Lionsgate looking to YouTube to try and find new sources of talent. Because, you know, if you're not creating movie stars here, you need to find them somewhere else. And maybe social media is a place to find them.
Yeah, that was a fun story to do because it's, you know, frankly, I'm not really from the generation that, you know, is poring over YouTube videos and, you know, obsessively watching makeup tutorials and Halloween DIYs every day. So, you know, it's kind of fascinating to see this world where there are, where real studios are trying to take, you know, this whole other trove of talent and kind of convert them into movie stars.
Well, you mentioned that it's not just Lionsgate, it's other studios as well, Warner Brothers and Disney. But you also mentioned that, you know what, despite the fact that you have a whole bunch of studios trying to turn to these, well, they're YouTube stars, they've got 3 million, 2 million subscribers on their channels on YouTube, as they're trying to turn to these stars as a way to reach millennials, but so far, nobody, none of these studios has actually found any success or cracked some kind of combination or code to turn these YouTube stars into traditional TV stars or movie content producers.
Yeah, exactly. And even the even Lionsgate's big get, Grace Helbig, who has about 3 million YouTube subscribers, and millions of views, obviously. You know, she tried to do a talk show on E! Last year, and that certainly wasn't a hit. So it's definitely still a challenge for people, the traditional world, to try to tap this market.
But there's no question it'll happen. I mean, they're showing that they're comfortable on camera, and therefore that skill will probably cross over at some point, and they'll find the right property with the right person. It's just like finding a star via, you know, rock and roll. You know, they're making music videos and you go, well, hey, they look fine on video, maybe they'll be good in a movie. Or finding people on radio or finding people in books. It's just another area to troll for talent, right? They put in all the work.
Exactly.
They rise above the level of everybody else, and you say, okay, I'll give them a shot.
Yeah, and you have seen some stuff break out. Like just this summer, we had two different movies that had YouTube ties in some respect that did huge box office, especially compared to their production budgets. You had Lights Out from Warner Brothers and New Line, which was adapted from a very short horror video that went viral on YouTube. And then you had Don't Breathe, which was made by Fede Alvarez, who was found because his short video went viral. And he went on to make the Evil Dead remake and also this movie. So, I mean, you see these kind of lightning in the bottle sort of ways in which it works. But what you haven't really seen so far is, you know, a person who does short, goofy jokes on YouTube, you know, becoming like a big comedy star, you know, like, is that person going to become the next Jim Carrey? I don't know. Like, we'll have to wait and see. It seems like that's where it's going, but it's another one of those things where they really haven't shown or proven that that's going to work.
But they're also inexpensive to produce, from my understanding. They don't cost
so far,
that much. And these are movies that cost, what, about $1 million, maybe. And are they actually earning money?
Yeah, well, I mean, I talked to an agent who represents these YouTube stars, and he said that these movies that cost, you know, $1 million to $2 million from YouTube stars can gross, you know, 4 to 10 times their production budgets, you know, from iTunes and other avenues. So, I mean, that's where they're doing most of their business at this point. These are micro-budget experiments, so they're not getting big theatrical releases. They're going on YouTube and iTunes and Amazon and Google Play and making their money that way. So if you're only spending $1 million on a movie, you know, there's just not all that much risk happening.
Well, so then the outlet isn't cinemas necessarily, but more digital and online.
Yeah, but when you talk to the people at Lionsgate and elsewhere, they are really hoping that these movies go beyond just the online crowd. They really are hoping for something to break out, like, you know, Lights Out or even Saw, which turned into a 7-film franchise, which is crazy when you think about it. That was also based on a very short video by James Wan. So that's the kind of thing that's worked so far. We'll see if it'll, you know, translate to comedy or action or anything like that.
Does it seem like Lionsgate is being smarter than other studios and being more proactive in this area, or are they just more desperate because they have sort of a rough patch right now?
Yeah, they have had a bit of a rough patch at the box office lately. I mean, I will point out that Boo a Madea Halloween was sort of unexpectedly a number one movie 2 weekends in a row recently, which is theirs, but they don't have anything on the level.
Well, they've got La La Land coming up in the fall, which is absolutely an Oscar hopeful.
Yeah, that looks pretty good too. I mean, there are other studios that are investing in these multi-channel networks, these YouTube networks that sort of foster the online followings for these personalities. Lionsgate's going in a slightly different direction, which is they're actually signing production deals with the talent and people who produce those videos, and they're actually trying to use those people to make actual, you know, more traditional looking content.
Well, you know, Michael, I still say that if this whole podcast thing doesn't work out, we should take up that Vine idea we had and, you know, start our own, you become Vine stars.
Good idea.
Vine's
good
gone,
idea.
Guys. Vine's gone. It's too late.
Oh, my. Are you kidding?
Besides, we'd have to start watching makeup tutorials so we could look good on camera.
Oh, that's never going to happen.
There you go.
We have voices for radio, but we also have the faces for radio as well.
Yes.
But maybe that means, well, you just said Vine is gone. Yes, that was my way of kind of mentioning the fact that Twitter said, hey, we created a whole bunch of Vine stars. We're now going to shut it down.
But nobody seems to care because, you know, they've already moved on to multiple platforms. So they may have gotten their launch there, but anybody smart enough to succeed has also put their programming on lots of other platforms. So nobody seems that upset.
Yeah, just ask Shawn Mendes.
Yeah, he's popular. He got to start on Vine.
Exactly. Well, Ryan Fonder, a staff reporter and staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and to discuss not only what Lionsgate is doing with YouTube stars, but also what's going on in China in regards to the Chinese box office.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is really fun.
Well, you know, that was good of Ryan to stop by. You know, we joke, but we have often talked about, should we be doing this show as a video as well as an audio podcast?
Yeah, I mean, the issue is, you know, yes, the answer is, yeah, we probably should, but there's only so many hours in the day.
And, you know, I see even people at the New Yorker, and you talk about an old school classic magazine. Even there, I see people who are becoming YouTube stars by, there was one grammarian, one copy proofreader who did a great book on grammar and spelling. And she became a YouTube star by doing short video clips about grammar and stuff like that. So everybody is branching out into YouTube.
Well, when it comes to writing, Michael, I know that there are very few that can hold a candle to you because you read so much, which is my way of bringing us to our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. Michael, what is the big book of the week, the one book you chose out of thousands that are coming out this week? What is the number one pick over on your site, bookfilter.com?
Well, that's why I mentioned The New Yorker, because it comes from The New Yorker. It's called Sequential Drawings by Richard McGuire. For many years, old-fashioned magazine layouts, before they had digital and all that, there'd be quirky little spaces left over because of how short or long a story ran and the way ads worked. And so there'd be a little blank space, and they would fill it in with just some drawings by various artists. But about a decade ago, they got Richard McGuire to start doing them, and he turned those little spaces, and he started to tell a story. It would stretch over, you know, many pages and many articles, but he'd tell a story or he'd do a variation on a theme like hats. And suddenly those little doodles became this lovely little pieces of art. And now they've all been collected together in this book called Sequential Drawings. It's a tiny little book. It's like a classic thinking person's stocking stuffer. It's funny. You'll buy it for somebody else and you won't be able to stop yourself from looking through it before you give it away. So it's a clever, good book. But there are also two books that I think are of special interest to the people who listen to Showbiz Sandbox. One is a memoir. It's called To Pixar and Beyond. It's by Lawrence Levy, who was a Silicon Valley person and a lawyer who was recruited by Steve Jobs to help him help launch Pixar. And it's his memoir about those days and what they did. I didn't get a chance to read it yet. That's why it's not my number one pick. And the other one is a coffee table book. It's called The Art of the Hollywood Backdrop. And it's a book celebrating those elaborate backdrops that have served Hollywood so well for its first 100 years. And it may be an art form that's sort of going out of business because of digital effects. But you can see the art of Hollywood backdrop in like almost any classic film you name. And this coffee table book shows those backdrops and what they were and what they look like on their own. And it's kind of a lovely, cool Hollywood coffee table book. So if you're looking for a gift, that's a great idea as well.
Now, I wonder, it would be interesting to have both David Price on and Lawrence Levy, because David Price wrote a book called The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company, back in 2009, I want to say, is when that book was published. And I thought we kind of had heard the whole Pixar birth story, so it would be interesting to kind of read both of them and compare.
Sure, yeah. I mean, one is from an insider and one is from an outsider giving their perspective.
Well, okay, but I hear the reviews for Paul Beatty's book, The Sellout, were pretty good. In fact, so good that he won the Man Booker Prize. Now, normally we wouldn't necessarily mention that, except this time, this year, it's a little bit different.
Well, it's the first, a few years ago, they opened it up to any English language novel, not just ones published in certain territories. So we've had Americans on the shortlist before. And now for the first time, an American has won the Man Booker Prize. And they couldn't have started that with a better book than The Sellout. This is a great blistering satire. It's kind of like Richard Pryor's stand-up at its rawest, combined with a really funny novel. It's just, it's incredibly breathtaking. It's really successful. It's moving. It's smart. It's funny. It's got an outrageous premise. And it's one of my favorite books of the last few years. So I was really delighted that it won the Man Booker Prize. So, we've got a link in our show notes. You can check out the book. It's really terrific. It's certainly, I think it's a very big deal. I know what you're trying to do. It's a big deal that he's the first American to win the Man Booker Prize. There you go. Do it.
All right. That's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Well, we need like theme music for this or something. I don't know. Our first story this week. Guess what, Michael? Bob Dylan. He finally acknowledged he is receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature. In his first interview in 2 years, Dylan told London's Telegraph newspaper he was surprised and pleased by the honor. Will he attend the ceremony? Absolutely, if it's at all possible. The interview was to promote an exhibit of his paintings. Dylan also has a metal sculpture going up in Maryland and in an archway for a casino, of all things. And whatever of his non-musical pursuits, what interests him? And he says, Michael, why don't you do this? Because, you do such a good Bob Dylan.
I'm not going to do Bob. And he said, I'd like to drive a race car on the Indianapolis track. I'd like to kick a field goal in an NFL football game. I'd like to be able to hit 100-mile-an-hour baseball. That's just classic Dylan as far as just a nutty, goofy, but imaginative response to a boring question. Not to put the interviewer down. But I'd point out a few things. It's his first interview in 2 years. All right. So when people say, oh, how come he didn't respond to the, why didn't he immediately put out a press release? Guess what? He hasn't even given an interview in 2 years. Maybe it's not arrogant. Maybe it's just who he is. And like dashing off a press release is not, refusing to do that is not necessarily a sign of rudeness. It's like maybe he's just a normal person and he's not prepared to immediately jump into the media fray just because he was given an honor. So he was doing an interview. He spoke about it. He was polite and friendly. Hopefully he'll show up. And if he doesn't, no big deal either way.
You mean it would be a big whoop?
It would be a big whoop.
Yeah, you know, if you really want to know Dylan's attitude about, or at least, you know, what it used to be, regarding the press, in that movie that I've mentioned a couple times now, Don't Look Back, there are a couple of segments where he, you know, this is a documentary about Dylan's tour of the United Kingdom in 1965, and I think it was 65, 66, somewhere in there, and he is being interviewed by a Time reporter, a reporter for the Time magazine, and he just shreds this reporter for asking these just kind of stupid questions, and it's actually quite funny because he's obviously playing a bit of a character, but he's also kind of shining a light back on the media by saying, look at what you guys are doing. And there are a couple times in there where he's being interviewed by groups of reporters, and he's just kind of like, why are you guys like so interested, and why are you asking me these questions? And yet the reality is, if they weren't, he wouldn't be Bob Dylan today.
Well, I don't agree with that necessarily. I just think that in the early 60s, the level of quality of coverage of pop music was pretty dismissive and banal, and that was what he's responding to. And of course, not responding to the Nobel Prize for Literature is not a comment on the media. It's a comment on awards. But I think the point is, look, just because somebody doesn't want to do interviews all the time doesn't mean they're a recluse. Just means they maybe don't want to be on the interview, you know, treadmill. And in this case, the first time he had an opportunity to speak, he did.
Well, and, you know, maybe he's out there, you know, I don't know, trying to kick a field goal at an NFL football game. I don't know.
Exactly.
But if I were the, you know, in charge of the Indianapolis Speedway, I would be getting him a race car stat. I'd be, that would talk about a press opportunity. Bob Dylan racing around the track in a race car? Come on.
Sure.
Okay. The Academy Awards, Michael, speaking of awards, would love for some big Hollywood movie with major stars become an Oscar favorite in the next 8 weeks. Because the bigger the stars and the bigger the movie, well, as you know, Michael, the more people watch the Oscars. And the money from that is a key source of revenue for the Academy. They can't control which movies catch fire, but they can control who hosts the show and who produces it. And well, on that count, they're doing not so good, actually, at all. This is the latest they've gone in many years without putting someone in charge, a producer, in part because the Academy doesn't know what kind of show it wants. ABC is sitting on the sidelines after signing a big deal, a big new deal, in fact, saying, guys, have you met Jimmy Kimmel? We're really fond of him. We gave him an entire show for an hour each night. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's becoming a big deal, right? Because it's a complicated show. Putting it on takes a lot of work, and usually people have been working on it for months by now, and they're not able to do that yet because nobody's in charge.
In fact, there are producers. It used to kind of be a revolving thing because, you know, these producers were also, you know, film producers. They had other careers, and they couldn't do it all the time because it would take 6 months out of their life. And one of the reasons some of them did it is because it put them in touch with everybody in Hollywood. So about every 5 years, you get this producer, this film producer that would want to kind of, you know, have everybody return his phone call or her phone call so they would actually do the show. And of course, you know, they would.
It's a great gig.
Yeah, it's a great gig for 6 months. You wouldn't want to do it every year, but, you know, here they are going, what kind of show do we want? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how they work things out. So you're saying it's a big deal then?
I do, yeah.
Okay. The creator of Mad Men is returning to TV and Amazon has got him in what was surely a major bidding war in which Matthew Weiner could write his own ticket. The mastermind of the show that put AMC on the map chose to go not to AMC or HBO or any one of those other three-letter networks, but Amazon. Not much is known about the show except that it is greenlit for 8 episodes and is an anthology series set in various locations around the world, which may be one reason Amazon and perhaps Netflix were especially eager to snap it up. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, right? He was going to be able to go anywhere he wants and do anything he wants, whether it's a good idea, whether it'll be a good show, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, I think the idea that it's an anthology and set it all over the world makes sense for Amazon because they do want to reach a worldwide audience. But, I mean, as far as actors who used to famously pick movies based on where they were being shot, I bet Michael Caine would be available for this series. It's like Paris, London, Moscow. All right, I'll do it.
Well, and that was almost too erudite for Michael Caine. You know, he's got a bit of a
It's just
cotton.
The look. He doesn't care what the movie is. He just wants to be in a nice warm look. You know,
no,
winter time, you're shooting in the Caribbean, I'll be there.
It was the accent, not the...
Oh, sorry.
He has a bit of the Cockney. No? Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Well, while Matthew Weiner is in over at Amazon, showrunner Brian Fuller is out at CBS All Access, sort of. Fuller is the creator of the late lamented Charmer Pushing Daisies, just one of a string of acclaimed shows he's overseen that have enjoyed big cachet and very small ratings. Shows like Dead Like Me, Wonderfalls, and most recently, Hannibal. Fuller is failing upwards.
I said falling.
Oh. Fuller is falling upwards, however, and along with his key role in the next Star Trek series, he is actively prepping the Netflix launch of the Neil Gaiman series American Gods and a revival of the anthology series Amazing Stories for NBC. With all that, CBS pushed back the debut of Star Trek, but felt like their prime jewel was simply not going to get the focus from Fuller that it deserved. It's probably true. So after working on the new mythology for Star Trek and the first two scripts, Fuller will no longer be the showrunner doing day-to-day work on the show. Meanwhile, they're still looking to cast the key central role, though it's slightly unclear if the lead is the female captain of the ship or the female lieutenant that may be our way into this world. We have no idea who the main character is. Big deal or big whoop.
I think it's just they know who it is. I think it's just from our perception, it's slightly unclear to me. I think maybe they're going to have the main character not be the captain, which will be, a new way of doing the show, which will give it a slightly different spin. Not being the top boss will be, you know, a way of keeping it fresh. It's a big deal. It's like, come on, you know, you were going to do this show. You're launching this show. You're passionate about the show, but you're just doing too many other things to focus. You know, why are you taking on an anthology series for NBC if you want to work, surely doing Star Trek is a full-time job.
Yes.
And, you know, so like, why are you saying yes to Amazing Stories? Why are you saying yes to other things? So I think it's a bit of a disappointment since he said he was very excited by the show, talked about it passionately, won fans over, and yet could not be bothered to actually focus on that show.
Yeah, it's funny because as I was reading this story, I thought, oh, wait, he's doing that too? Oh, and he's got this other, like, what? Some of us would kill for one job. This guy's got like 9.
Right. It's just, you're not going to do a good job for American Gods and Amazing Stories and Star Trek when you do all three at the same time. One TV show is a full-time 365 days a year job.
Correct.
It is. It really is.
Okay, so let's clarify things, Michael. Don't upload those Oscar screeners you're sent to the internet. So don't do that,
what?
Michael. Yeah,
what?
Don't do that.
Okay.
And don't sell them to pirates, by the way, either. Okay?
Okay.
Oh, one last thing. Don't post them on Google Drive for everyone at your company to have access to, including people at other agencies who you give access to in exchange for screeners that you don't already have. That's the lesson being learned by Innovative Artists, one of whose clients was traced as the source of a leak for the Oscar hopefuls Creed and In the Heart of the Sea. That led to the Google Drive account and the info on all the people who shared that Google Drive account. Innovative cooperated with Warner Brothers when the leak was brought to their attention, but Warner Brothers is now, well, suing them, stating the obvious that the company should have known what they did was illegal. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, I guess. But I mean, really, like, you're a client of Innovative and they send you a screener before you even get it. Innovative took it and ripped it and put it on their Google Drive. So it wasn't even the client doing it. So this is pretty bad.
You know, worked at agencies, I can tell you back in the days when the tapes come. And why are these things sent to the agencies? Why? Because some of these people, movie stars or actors or actresses or directors, they don't want their address.
Right, they want their privacy. Yeah.
Right. So you send everything to the agency. The agency then sends it on to the talent. And what would wind up happening is the assistants would get it and make copies of the videos, whether it was VCR or DVD. They would find a way to make a copy of it and then send it on to whoever it was originally intended for.
And now it's just happening in a fancier way.
And frankly, it's happening in a much smarter way in terms of like the ability to like do it Google Drive. Hey, that's pretty smart. And it used to be, yes, you would talk to your friends at other agencies and, you have Titanic. Oh, I've got some other film. Okay, well, we'll swap. Okay.
The problem is when you're dumb enough to let so many people involved in it that it leaks online.
Correct. And, you know, here it's probably Innovative Artists is probably, it's not the agent. I would be really.
No, it's, of course it's not.
It's probably an assistant or two who did this and they were smart about it, but they're going to pay a hefty price for it. Now that brings us to, well, football and the other sport, football, two of the biggest sports in the world. they're suffering major drops in the ratings this season. As I mentioned, one is the NFL, the National Football League, the purveyors of American football. The other is the Premier League, the purveyors of what everyone else in the world calls football. But whether you dub these games football or football or soccer, suddenly and rather dramatically, people aren't watching as much of it as they used to. Ratings are down in the double digits, some 12% so far in the US and down 20% in the UK for soccer. League officials are, of course, talking a good game, but privately concerned they may have hit their peaks in viewership and be in for less rosy numbers in the future. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, it's obviously going to be a long, long time before these are not the huge rating draws that they are. They're not going away. Baseball is nowhere near what it used to be, but it's still a huge sport. You know, football and football are going to remain huge TV draws for a long time, but still, this is a pretty serious drop off. It is pretty sudden, and it may be a sign of things to come rather than some blip. I mean, are people using the DVR more? I don't think so. Or is it cord cutters because they don't get network TV and thus access to live sports? I don't think as much, because as much as we watch and pay attention to the numbers, people still basically pay for cable TV, don't they?
Yes, indeed. Well, we'll talk about a little more about that later, but yeah, they do.
Yeah. Is it the fact that, like, American football in particular has a lot of bad press and a lot of bad reasons why people might start to turn away? The pileup of medical issues like concussions, domestic violence from players, brain trauma, the national anthem protests going on right now. It's an election year. That's one reason why there's lower ratings for American football. But you put all that up together, and that's not a great recipe for the future. But I think the biggest reason is there's too much football. They got too greedy. You will not find college football on Saturday, and you'll find the NFL on Sunday and Monday and Thursday and Friday and probably some other night of the week. It used to just be on Sunday and then Monday, and they've stretched that to every night of the week. The same is happening with the Premier League. They've gotten too greedy. They've got football on too many nights of the week. It just takes up too much of your time, and suddenly at some point you go enough and you walk away a little bit from it, and I think that's what they're doing.
Well, yeah, I call it the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire effect. They put it on every single night of the week, and within a year, it was dead.
Right. Well, it wasn't the problem that they did it every night of the week. They did it every night of the week for a burst in the summer as a sort of a mini-series type thing, and it worked fine. Then if they did it again next year and the year after that for that, you know, eight-week period, that would have been fine, but they just made it every night of the week for the whole season. You know, that was the problem. They had it as a punchy series right in the middle of the summer. Great. But they wanted to have it for 40 weeks of the year, and that's when they got greedy.
You know who didn't get greedy? ABBA. The Swedish group, you might know them, ABBA, was once offered $1 billion to tour. The money was to go to the charity or charities of their choice. And they said, no. They could write their own ticket, and it could be a golden ticket, a la Willy Wonka. They always say, no. Maybe it's easier to just let other people sing your songs in the musical Mamma Mia, a cash cow of major proportions. Well, ABBA have finally said yes, and they're saying yes to virtual reality. So did they really say yes, or is it just kind of like a... Anyway, the group announced they are working with one-time American Idol producer Simon Fuller on a virtual reality production that would let fans experience the band in ways never before imagined. By the way, you know one way that we could experience the band in a way that we never before imagined? Show up to a concert! Get on stage! They'll explain what they're talking about in 2017, and the actual thing itself could see the light of day in 2018, so buy your VR goggles now. Big deal or big whoop?
I actually think it's a big deal. I think this is what acts will do. You know, when you realize the potential and the possibility before you're dead, you know, to actually film yourselves and get all the stuff and the work you need to do good VR for right now and then decades into the future, you know, you capture it now and you have a lot more material to work with and figure out what you want to do with it down the road.
Well, I know one of the reasons they stopped touring was Agnetha Faltskog was afraid of flying, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true, yeah, and the others don't want to do it without her, and she just doesn't want to tour, and, you know, I mean, Fleetwood Mac continued on without Christine McVie for many years, and now she's back in the fold, but they clearly just, you know, I mean, she could obviously take a cruise ship for some one big show in Europe or take the train if she wanted to do a big concert and make $1 billion and give it to charity. You know, that makes it sound petty. Like, if they wanted to do a show, they could do shows in Europe without her flying. That would be possible. You wouldn't have to arrange a world tour where you had to be in every city, you know, that next day.
No, no.
clearly, anybody would do anything to make it happen. So they choose not to tour. They choose not to do live con. They're saying, hey, look, that was our heyday, and that was many years ago, and we're not going to try and recreate that. I respect it.
You know, I honestly think you're absolutely right. You know, she could, well, the whole band could get to, say, London or Amsterdam or someplace, right? And it would be a destination concert. People would fly in for the
show.
Like
Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden. He does one show a month.
Right. And you don't have to, you know, I can't remember. It's like a residency, effectively.
Yeah, so they're basically saying, look, we're done. We did it then. That was our heyday. We're not going to, you know, just tour to flog old material. And they've got all the money in the world, and they choose not to do it. More power to them.
You know what their agent says?
Please, please.
Oh, I was going to make a Mamma Mia.
Oh, God. Their agent's Italian.
Okay, so the final word is in. On the Olympics, that is. Apparently, Michael's dreams of a significant lift in viewership from DVR usage proved to be just that, dreams. Most nights apparently saw about 1 million more viewers, once live plus 3 DVR viewers were added in, with everyone apparently preferring to watch primetime as it aired. Mind you, there were record viewing, you know, there was record viewing, Michael, and we talked about this, online during the actual events as they took place hours earlier. More importantly to NBC, it announced the 2016 games were the most profitable in the network's history, netting the company more than $250 million in profits, along with a primetime audience 4 times bigger than the other 3 broadcast networks combined. Ryan Lochte? Still a ding-dong. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They made money off the Olympics. They made money in more new ways. They're poised for the future. I am surprised by the Live Plus 3 numbers, but I don't see why we'd have to wait 3 months to get them. So, you know, just give them to us at the time. If they're low, they're low. If they're high, they're high. I just want to know what they are. So I'm a little surprised that there wasn't, for various reasons, why they didn't do better with taped viewing. But hey, those are the facts.
Do people still use the word ding dong, or is it knucklehead? What's the better phrase?
Oh, ding dong is just fine.
Okay. Glenn Close, by the way, Michael, she is returning to Broadway next February in her Tony-winning role of Norma Desmond, the aging star of the musical Sunset Boulevard. It famously ran on Broadway for about 2 years, but was so expensive to mount, it actually lost money. It also lost money on the road, thanks to a hugely elaborate set and a massive orchestra. Well, forget the lavish set. The new production is almost a concert staging of the show. On the other hand, the 40-piece orchestra is believed to be the biggest in Broadway history, but musicians are a lot cheaper than swimming pools, so maybe this time they'll actually make money. And if Close gets sick, Patti LuPone will be happy to step in for her. If you don't know what that's a reference to, just Google Glenn Close, Patti LuPone, Sunset Boulevard, and you can read all about it. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a big whoop. She's returning to Broadway, 16-week limited run, you know, revival of a show. It is cool, though. There is a nifty Broadway bit of trivia that you pointed out. Andrew Lloyd Webber will have 4 shows on Broadway at the same time. That's awfully rare. I think Rodgers and Hammerstein have done it. Andrew Lloyd Webber did it before. I think that's practically about it. But he'll have Sunset Boulevard, School of Rock, Cats, and a show that never left Broadway, Phantom of the Opera.
Now, I would just like to point out to Brian Fuller, that's how you run 4 different shows at the same time. You write them 20 years beforehand, then actually have them run. That's the way you do it. But yeah, I mean, of course, this is based on Billy Wilder's film, Sunset Boulevard. Did you see the original production?
I did. It's not good.
What do you really think? So are you going to try and see this one?
Oh, well, I'll certainly go if they give me a ticket. Absolutely. But I saw her do it. I actually interviewed Betty Buckley for her performance of it. She did it on tour or in London. I think she took it over perhaps for when Patti LuPone was done. And she wrote a piece for New York Magazine about her take on the role, which was also a sly dig at Glenn Close's take on the role. But that's divas for you.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And certainly this week, this story will definitely affect people in, well, I guess it's really just the United States because Canada has their own cable companies. But we talked last week about the merger of AT&T and Time Warner, and it's not really a merger. AT&T is buying Time Warner, taking on loads of debt to do it. And of course, the question is, will this deal be approved by regulatory bodies? And, you know, we all had our opinions about it last week, whether it was good or bad for consumers. We kind of felt like, how could this possibly be good for consumers? But this week, the story continues, of course.
That's right. And the funniest first part of the story includes people getting confused about which two companies are involved.
Oh, yes. I almost skipped right over this part. And this part kind of...
You love this.
I love this because people would write into us and say, you know, you're talking about Time Warner Cable, and Time Warner and Time Warner Cable are two different companies. You know, Time Warner sold Time Warner Cable. Yes, they did. They sold it off. Time Warner Cable is no longer a part of Time Warner and hasn't been since, I think, 2009, which, of course, begs the question as to why Time Warner would now think being a part of another cable provider would actually be something that's good for them, since they actually owned a cable provider. That's another story. But that said, AT&T had to clarify in their own comments to the SEC and to other, you know, regulatory bodies that they're talking about Time Warner, the media company, and not Time Warner Cable, the you know, cable operator.
Well, you know, it's not just AT&T trying to tell people, hey, don't get this confused. Hilariously, the Senate Judiciary Committee wanted to start hearings on this, and they sent out invites to CEOs, and they sent an invite to the CEO of Time Warner Cable rather than Time Warner. So the Senate Judiciary Committee invited the wrong executive.
And other media companies were doing the same thing. So we were getting chastised for it because we weren't kind of differentiating. It's not that we got confused, as is my...
Right. Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee actually got it wrong. So that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah, so it's Time Warner, not Time Warner Cable. It's happening. And I think it's fair to say that there's sort of a growing chorus of not so fast. Like, they want to make a sense of inevitability. Oh, it's going to happen. And there's going to be some restrictions. And there'll be a time limit on them, just like Comcast. But you can't possibly say this shouldn't happen because there's so much precedent for it. So it would just be silly. So just accept it's going to happen. Well, now some people are saying, well, gee, I don't know. That last one, that merger of Comcast, didn't work so well. People aren't really happy about it and the fallout from it. Did it really benefit consumers? Perhaps not. So why should this one happen?
Well, and the question is, what benefit is it to either company? I mean, technically, AT&T could just license the Time Warner content, okay? They don't necessarily need to buy them to get that content, because the reality is Time Warner, as a company, can't just distribute through AT&T to AT&T customers. Otherwise, nothing they own would be valuable. They also have to distribute through Comcast. They have to distribute through DirecTV. They have to distribute through all of the other channels.
Well, right. It's not the job of regulators to say whether this is a smart business decision or a bad business decision, right? I think the frame that they want to put on it is, will this make competition, will this, you know, make one company too powerful? That's sort of the angle they want to look at. And my point is, well, just say, is this going to clearly be great for consumers? If it's not clearly going to be great for consumers, why allow two such huge companies to merge? And if your answer is not yes, it will clearly be good for consumers, then perhaps you should say it shouldn't go forward.
Well, and then there is this discussion that's finally really kind of coming to the fore. It was kind of brought up previously, but now it's really kind of being discussed. It's this, the birth of the vMVPD.
Now, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, so the MVPD part of that is an industry acronym for multi-channel video programming distributor. Effectively, that's what Comcast is.
That's what DirecTV and cable companies are.
Correct.
Right.
The V.
Right. And so we're talking. The V means you just do it over the internet.
Virtual. Yeah. That's basically what that is. So
okay. What
does this mean? So AT&T is announcing, hey, you know what we're going to do with DirecTV is we're going to have DirecTV Now. Now, if that sounds familiar, no pun intended, it's because of HBO Now, right? So they are basically saying, you know what, you won't have to be a DirecTV subscriber. You'll pay $35 a month for this new service that we're putting together. It's called the base.
Well, you'll be a DirecTV subscriber. You just be a subscriber to Now rather than the satellite dish. You get it over the internet.
Yeah, you don't need something on your roof. You don't need something. You don't need a set-top box because it's all.
But you are a subscriber. You're a subscriber. You're
yes.
Just a subscriber to DirecTV Now.
Correct.
Right.
DirecTV Now, not DirecTV. Yes, correct. So for this $35 a month, you get the base offering with sports, including ESPN. Okay. Anyone can sign up, not just DirecTV customers. No contract. So it's month to month, no box. It works in your home or out of your home. So it's somewhat similar to Sling, okay? Like the Sling box and Sling TV, where you can watch it.
No, Sling is just a device to help you watch the programming you already pay for. It's not like Sling at all.
And that's what I thought. However, there is you know, because I have a Sling box, right? But Sling has kind of become a Sling TV. So you can actually, they have their skinny bundle, the Sling skinny bundle. That's pretty much, they're basically copying Sling. That's really what
Sling
this is.
Sling does not, do either of them have all four networks?
I don't know about that.
Sling certainly does not.
I don't know,
there's
and
no
I should have checked
does,
that.
Or we'd be talking about it.
There's also no triple play. Okay, and what does that mean? No bundling of services. They're not going to say, well, if you get DirecTV Now and phone and internet, it'll be cheaper. No, it's...
So, well, you're confusing everything. Why are we suddenly talking about virtual over the internet? We've known people who want to offer, you know, TV programming over the internet rather than a cable line.
So why are we talking about one and
yeah,
the other?
Yeah, why are we not talking about the AT&T
Time Warner.
Time Warner merger? Why are we suddenly talking about this?
Because it all plays into the same scheme. And this and what I'm referring to here is at $35 a month, effectively what AT&T is saying is we are willing to lose money on delivering video, okay, for this base offering. Of course, they will have higher tiers. Oh, you want more channels? Okay, how about like $60 and you'll get 100 more channels? You'll get 100 in the base offering, 100 more for $60. They're willing to say it's going to cost us $35 a month with all the marketing and infrastructure to pay for the channels and deliver it to you. And we're willing to lose money on it.
And that's not an argument for letting the merger go through, is it? They're saying we're going to lose money on it because we're going to try to quash the competition.
Well, it's not that they're losing money. They're going to barely, I shouldn't say lose money. They're willing to make no money on it because the margins
right,
will be
and
incredibly
thus drive
slim.
Away all competition, and then they'll be free to raise money and raise the cost if they want to.
But here's the thing. If they do this, then Comcast, there's a question of whether Comcast will, and by the way, other providers, will be forced to go national, right, and do the same exact thing and offer their Xfinity for Comcast or whatever Spectrum is going to offer as Time Warner Cable.
Right. We understand the bigger they are, the more they can bundle both the off the internet and the services together and offer it at a cheaper price than their competition, thus quashing competition. That's the whole point.
But here's the thing. Is it quashing competition or is it offering more competition? Because right now I can't be a Comcast subscriber, okay? I can't because they're in Northern California, not Southern California. However, if they go national with this vMVPD, I could turn to Time Warner Cable, now Spectrum, and say, you know what, guys? I'm going to cancel my subscription with you because you're too expensive, and I'm just going to get this skinny bundle over here from Comcast that's going to be delivered over the internet, so I don't need you anymore. Thank you very much. And so it actually, what AT&T is trying to show here is how competition could
Nothing
be
Nothing is
increasing.
Stopping them from doing that right now. They don't need to merge with Time Warner. Time Warner just give them access to all four networks. Time Warner does not give them access to everything. They can, if they want to offer a bundle over the internet, they can do it today. It's hard to make the deal happen, but it is what everybody's trying to do, and this merger does not have to happen. And Apple wants to do it. Amazon wants to do it. There are 1,000 companies struggling to sign up all four networks and a big, good enough cable bundle, a bundle of TV channels, so that they can offer this over the internet. Everybody wants to do this. The merger of Time Warner and AT&T does not have to happen in order for AT&T to try and join along with Apple and Amazon and everybody else to offer this.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Because you can't.
The Wall Street analysts aren't disagreeing with you.
Because they can't.
Industry pundits aren't disagreeing with you. This is AT&T's way of saying, look, look, everything's going to be fine. Look, we're even offering this thing with the $35 a month. And
again, they can't offer because they don't have all four networks signed up yet.
No, that's the thing. They have two of the networks, two of the big networks.
My mother has two of the networks signed up. Getting all four is the difficult thing.
Exactly. And by the way, I'll take your mother's MVPD program.
She's got a great vMVPD. What about the advertising? We mentioned the fact that they said, oh, hey, this is going to be a great deal because we can do targeted advertising. What is that about?
Well, I guess what they're assuming here, and by the way, that's the same thing with these bundles. If they can get mass, if they can get like, you know, basically scale, then they can basically turn to advertisers and say, look, we have all these people accessing our programming or programming through our distribution service. Let us deliver advertising for you as well, because we know which people like diapers and which people like beer and which people, they'll know what everybody wants to see and they can target ads more directly.
And I think so great. And so it's not exactly a fun thing. It's creepy. And what happens is I go online and I look for a product for a couple days, like a mattress. And then suddenly for the next 6 months, I get mattress ads everywhere I go.
That's correct.
It doesn't work that well to me.
Well, okay. Let's talk for a second about a couple things. Because whether we agree AT&T and Time Warner should merge or not merge or buy or, you know, whatever, whether this whole vmvpd thing is who cares or whether
that's nothing to do with it. That's a separate issue.
Well, it's separate, but it's kind of like this underlying, like, subtle kind of, oh, you look, everything's
it's not so subtle. They say, oh, let us merge and we'll give you a great deal.
Well, they were already doing this. AT&T was already discussing
and of course they were. Yes. So was everybody.
Right. So is everybody. So what does it mean for the industry at large and thus to us? Okay. So we've already talked about how DirecTV is willing to make very little, if no money, on video. Okay. They're also looking for the data. We talked about that. Why? For the targeted advertising. The question about whether other providers, cable operators, will actually launch nationwide, that's up for debate, right? And cable companies, they're delivering right now wireline. They have a wire coming out of their head end into your home. That's the way they do it, right? The question is, well, wait a second. AT&T is a wireless company, okay? Are we delivering our content over, you know, obsolete or soon-to-be obsolete technology? If so, do we need to go wireless? Because that's probably the next phase. And so do cable companies need to go wireless? And if you look at what Comcast is doing, they're bidding very heavily on some wireless spectrum. The question is, why? Well, we kind of know why. The other thing is, Michael, if you are lucky enough to have two homes or you have a home and an office and you wanted a subscription at your office and a subscription at home and a subscription for your summer house out in the Hamptons, guess what? You needed 2-3 subscriptions. However, with these vmvpd subscriptions, you don't, because it's all on the internet. You just log in there.
Meaning it's so much better for you.
Well,
yeah. Everybody wants portable that they can watch anywhere.
Well, yes, correct. No, it's actually bad for the cable providers, because they used to be able to get 2 subscriptions for somebody who had 2 homes.
It's not, because most people are not going to pay 2 subscriptions. It's
right.
Just providing access to your customers wherever they are, and restricting them to a physical location is stupid.
Well, that said, let's say it's even 5 or 10% of the business, okay? Well,
it's not.
Well, but guess what? It's going away.
How many people have 10% of their, you know, double, you know, 1 out of 10 people have 2 cable subscriptions?
Well, my feeling is that 10% probably doesn't even know they have 2 cable subscriptions, because somebody else is paying for it, or somebody else is, you know, paying the bills.
There aren't that many people with second homes and yachts.
Speak for yourself. Wait, yachts? I don't have one of those. I don't have a second home either, so I don't have to worry about
it. Well, as Al Franken told the New York Times, he says, when the company that controls the pipes, so to speak, owns this very, very large content provider, it can cause a whole bunch of different horribles for consumers.
I loved that quote. I loved it.
Yeah.
The other thing is, and this I think could happen, and that is it's called continuity risk. And what that means now, Michael, is if you subscribe to, I guess it's Comcast or is it Time Warner Cable where you are? It's Time Warner Cable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you did it because you like baseball, right? But you kind of needed to keep it, you know, it's usually a contract and you have to keep it for 12 months, but you also want to see Stranger Things in the summer. So you're going to cancel Time Warner Cable, but you can't really do that because it has a 12-month. Well, right now, that's difficult. In the future, with these, you know, virtual MVPDs, the ability to sign up for sports for like 2, 3, 4 months and then cancel and then go sign up for Netflix for 5 months and then come back to cable, that's a lot more doable. So rather than getting 12 months of business, cable providers might only get a certain percentage of the year.
Well, they're just providing more flexibility to their customer.
Right.
And they will benefit long term, because if they're providing a better product, they'll make more money, right?
That's my feeling, is that, yes, I might not be your customer for 12 months, but I'll be your customer every year in perpetuity for 3 or 4 or 5.
Well, so it's a big mess. It's not necessarily a slam dunk. There's an economics debate. Between apparently the last 50 or 60 years, the Chicago School of Economics has held sway, and they've argued, no, these vertical mergers are actually good for competition. You're just creating a healthy company that can compete with other people. Whereas there's now a new young brand of economics, young Turks coming in saying, well, they're looking at this the wrong way. And in fact, these vertical mergers and these vertical integration is not good for competition. And so they're perhaps going to start holding sway, or they're trying to establish their bona fides. So we'll have to see which school of thought holds sway from that point of view. But it's going to be a big debate. Will it happen? Probably, because they have powerful lobbyists. They want it to happen. So we'll have to see.
But certainly we can look. You know, one of the things I always talk about, Michael, is I wonder what's going on in other countries. And that's my way of trying to get people to write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Because I want to know. I know in certain countries, like, you know, in France and the UK and most of Europe and in certain parts of Latin America, I know what's going on. But here we actually have CJ Flynn of Digital Test Tools, who I actually saw at the SMPTE conference last week. There was the annual technical conference, and I ran into him. And he sent us an email here about what he used to pay in France and could still pay if he lived in France.
That's right. And we know that the broadband speeds in Europe are much, for most of the world, are much better than North America. They have better quality and lower prices. And that's exactly what this is about. He writes, "Hey guys, this article about Time Warner being eaten by AT&T reminded me about something I've forgotten to send in for a while. Here's what we paid for broadband and TV and phone in France using Orange, which is the name that France Telecom changed its name to when it stopped being a phone company, or strictly a phone company. The last one there, 34 euros, he's got a screen grab of the three different price levels. For 34 euros, they got a half a gig downloading, 200 megs uploading, a box that stores 450 gigabytes of DVR usage, and a phone line. And the live box that they mentioned is the decoder Wi-Fi box, which they seem to charge 3 euros a month for. So you're talking about 34 euros a month, which is about what in U.S. dollars, Sperling?
Figure it's maybe $40, maybe.
About $40 a month for phone, cable, and internet at much better speeds than most people get in North America. $40. And he says, is there any wonder we feel ripped off paying what we do here in the U.S.?
Yeah, no, it's not a wonder. I think we all feel ripped off, and we're trapped.
Because we are.
And by the way, if you don't like what Orange has to offer, you can go to SFR. You know, so it's there is competition there. You don't have to stick with Orange.
Well, two companies is not a lot of competition.
Well, I just picked the one I knew. Okay. You know, there might be others. I just, you know, it's the one I happen to know off the top of my head.
Right. The point in Europe is that you have public access to the home, and so you have public utilities taking you right to the home, and then different companies trying to vie for your services, but they all have access. There isn't just one line into your home that is owned by a monopoly like in New York City, Time Warner Cable. So that if you want to compete with them, you got to have satellite dishes on your roof and be DirecTV or something like that.
Correct. Yes.
So there's 5 or 10 companies can compete all to provide that last mile service into your home.
Yes. And that's what we need. Darn it.
And that's what's not going to happen with a merger of AT&T and Time Warner.
I say where's your pitchfork, Michael? Let's get going.
Well, I want more competition. It's a separate issue in a way of whether this merger is good or bad, but we want competition into the home, and perhaps we're going to get it by the end run of the internet. Isn't that the argument?
That is correct, yes.
You won't need cable lines. You won't need a satellite dish. You'll all be able to do it over the internet, which means we'll just have to pay a lot more for our internet service.
That's probably what's going to wind up happening.
That alone is still a monopoly for most cities.
That is correct. Well, especially now, Google Fiber, they're kind of saying, yeah, you know, this isn't such a good business for us. We're probably not going to keep doing this.
Yeah.
But again, CJ wrote to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He could have called and left a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, then he couldn't have sent us this lovely picture. You can also subscribe to our show, iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, or any podcast aggregator. We should be there. If we're not, let us know. You can email us or call us and let us know. You can also rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to the stories we've discussed on today's episode. It's also where you'll find ways to follow us, our Twitter. That was the word I was looking for. Our Twitter handle is @ShowbizSandbox. We're also on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up and you can like us there. We're not on Vine, unfortunately, or fortunately, since they're going away. All of that information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Boy, it would be great to have a new album from them. They have a website. Their website is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it, Michael?
This week it's Orange is the New Black.
.com. You know what I love is the fact that we're both calling it Orange instead of Orange, which is what English speakers usually call a word spelled like orange.
Well, it's Orange in France.
That's correct. Now, if you can't find any of... Oh, I get it. Orange is the New Black. I get it. It's like a show on Netflix. It took me a while. Yeah. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that particular website, why not head on over to the Huffington Post? Or you can kind of see all of his work on michaelgiltz.com. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.